Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turteltaub from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today from London is Jane Mitchell. Jane is the owner and director of her own consultancy, JL&M. Jane, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Afternoon for you, morning for me.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. It's terrific to be here. Thanks very much for inviting me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
As am I. Now, Jane, for those of you not familiar with her, has been a frequent speaker at SCCE events on the topic of culture. And we'll be speaking at our 2019 European Compliance and Ethics Institute. We're going to dive right into that topic. So, Jane, what are some of the key dimensions of a corporate culture?
Well, I think in regards to our EEI audience, Adam, and historically since the birth of Sarbanes-Oxley, I think, culture was and still is to an extent interpreted through the lens of compliance. And so regulations are vague, and they suggest that compliant cultures indicate an ethical culture. However, what does that mean? It's a conversation we've had at the SCCE for many years now. And I think that before you can define the dimensions of a corporate culture, you need to understand how it's created. And that's at the heart of many of the discussions that we've had. Culture, I think, or we think certainly, is what happens when an individual's behaviors meet an organization's. It's as simple as that, really. Every day when we come into work, we carry a whole host of behavioral preferences with us. When we sit down at our desk, you know, or our machine, or stand at the front of our store with that kind of Richter's grin on our face, ready to welcome customers, those preferences collide with all of the ways that our company tells us it wants us to behave. And it's at that inflection point between those two forces, the personal preference, the organizational imperative, where culture is created, formed, and potentially broken. So when we talk about measuring culture or evidencing culture or professing culture, we are in effect, I suppose, talking about behavior. And the key dimensions of a corporate culture are the mixture of behaviors that are called for by an organization's purpose, strategy, or indeed, and possibly most importantly, its values. It's in the language of those things that employees understand how the organization expects them to behave. However, the key question for me is, do the organization's structure, the processes, the systems, the strategy, the organizational design, and all of that support those behaviors? That for us defines whether a culture is healthy or not. Interestingly enough, in 2018, we asked delegates in Frankfurt at the ECEI what they thought were the key dimensions. And they came up with a very, very long list, but that included things like respect, listening, compliance programs, behaviors, speak up, tone at the top, consistent communications, decision making, and more. And I think it's all of the above. And the challenge is to recognize and embrace all of those dimensions.
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge. I mean, given how all pervasive culture is, and both, you know, the important things like, you know, integrity and things like that, as well as the smaller things. I mean, it gets down to even what kind of clothes are acceptable to work. And, you know, one of the things I used to find funny when I worked in advertising is when you'd meet a client for lunch, depending on what company they were at, you knew what time they were going to eat lunch. You know, in some cultures, they eat early, some eat late. It pervades everything, and is one of those things where I think we lose track when we're in it of how pervasive cultures are. Now, we talk a lot about how the right culture makes all the difference, but can you give us some example of how these dimensions translate into a more ethical, compliant culture?
So I was really interested by your question. I'm really interested by your question because I'm not sure. So forgive me, but I'm not sure that a compliant culture necessarily equates with an ethical culture. So let me explain why. If we accept that one distinction between compliance and ethics is that of following rules versus, say, discretionary values-based behaviours, then what impact is there of an overly compliant culture when a situation arises that requires some decisions and there are no rules to govern the answer? It's a question we often ask organisations, because when there are no rules, how, and you're used to working only with rules, then how do you respond? It's a really interesting debate that ensues usually. In fact, some of the behavioural research that we've done at Carrion and Box, and I'll be talking with James at Berlin about this, the behavioural research we've conducted suggests that less compliance and more autonomy, say, might be a good thing for ethical culture, because this gives employees the responsibility themselves, and it's seen as a positive thing for them to take hold of, rather than another control mechanism from on high that tells them what they should be doing. Another thing, speaking up is important too, though again, it's important to point out that the onus is on the organisation to get it right. It's not just about people being told that they should speak up. It's organisational support that's really key to developing and embedding that sense of psychological safety, which, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, is now one of these big cultural aspects that's taking hold, the notion of psychological safety. You can ask people to speak up till you're blue in the face, but the listener is more important than the speaker. And you need to proactively go out and get people to speak up. And I would say to leaders, you know, don't be the one who thinks it's okay to stop at my door is always open. The very fact that you say you have a door indicates that there may be a barrier in the first place. And another aspect of this that we found really important is helping leaders to understand that the behaviour they walk past and tolerate is the culture that they ultimately encourage and takes hold. And on the converse, of course, it's important to show the positive effects on those who do speak up. Organisational justice is very closely linked to speaking up. And if people see positive or negative consequences for people who share their opinion or point to something wrong, that will colour their own view, which takes us, of course, right back to the need for strong listening. Get those things right, and the third critical aspect, decision making, is much easier. And as you know, as we all know, some of the decisions that we've seen made have led organisations into some very tricky situations over the years.
Well, and you make a good point there for leaders that I don't want us to lose track of. It's important what you do as a leader, but it's also notable what you don't do. People do notice what does get overlooked, what does get not acted upon as things that send signals as well. So what's the best way to assess if your culture is in the right place? Surveys get used a lot, but they always make me nervous, since employees know what answers you're looking for. They know what the company wants them to say as an answer to a lot of the questions.
Yeah, that is a really interesting question, and one that we all hear a lot when we're talking about culture. And I think your nervousness is well placed, because the worry is that people are just responding in the way that they think you want them to. It's one of the issues in asking questions on a purely sentiment basis. So, you know, this the 40 strong Likert scale question survey, which most people will be familiar with, will have all of the normative bias that creates. So, without wanting to teach anybody how to suck eggs, normative bias is a characteristic of surveys that ask respondents the extent to which they agree with a norm statement, such as, I feel proud to work for this company. It's pretty clear what that norm is, so people start to trend towards it. So your nervousness is absolutely right. And it is how you interpret it. But that's not to say that those kinds of surveys don't have power, but they should realistically focus on more than broad sentiment. So, you know, going past it to ask questions that deal with actual behaviours and deep-seated cultural practices so that they feel real and that you can recognize where there may be gaps and what action you need to take. In addition, multiple methodologies help. So for example, some of what we'll be talking about in Berlin will be about how to use multiple scales and different methodologies, including some different and, you know, behavioral diagnostics, but it's still in an online survey vehicle because, of course, you know, an online survey vehicle has many merits. It's efficient, gathers data very quickly, helps to give you an overview. My concern about surveys is not necessarily the data that they produce, actually, but the way that they are then implemented or responded to and listened to. One aspect, and it's sort of inherent in your question, I think, is that it's really important to think about qualitative data. Without it, we think you're just running endless diagnostics without ever explaining why you're seeing what you're seeing. So at last year's conference in Frankfurt, we quoted the Deloitte Compliance Week 2016 report. And in that, it showed, much to everybody's shock in our audience in Frankfurt, that only 14% of companies that were included in the survey ever actually spoke to employees in the normal course of their engagement activities. There isn't an update to that survey. It'd be really interesting to explore whether or not that number's increased. But it is about the dialogue, as you've often said in the past at the SCCE. It's when you start talking to people that you'll get a very different and personal perspective. And the two, those two aspects, if we were to, you know, finely tune to an online survey plus the qual, in addition to all the other multiple methodologies, will give you a much better overview and, you know, reduce the levels of nervousness in people like yourself, Adam.
Thank you. Well, I don't think my level of nervousness will ever be reduced. but it's more about me than we need to get into. So we talked a little bit about this before, about what leaders actually do versus what they walk past without acknowledging, I think was the analogy used. What should leaders be doing to help shape the culture?
Yeah, that's a really good question too. Leaders have to have the courage to ask the right questions. Celebrate the reds and question the greens was a phrase I was given by a leader in a big organization. You know, if people are telling you everything's okay all of the time, then start to question it. Recognize the impact of a siloed organization in terms of the information they receive, I think, because, you know, for as long as data and reporting exist in splendid isolation from each other, for instance, whistleblowing data, engagement surveys, cultural assessments, governance reports, et cetera, et cetera. Boards and leaders won't connect any dots to make sense of the broader state of their ethical culture, and they'll, you know, see problems in pockets and react to those problems, whereas what they need is an integrated view of the whole enterprise that gives them a better sense of what's happening. They should be clear and articulate what they want their culture to be. For instance, is it a shared culture? Pervasive through the organization? Is it enduring, self-reinforcing, you know, and implicit through the organization's language and instinctive way of doing things? They need to get a better sense of whether or not that's happening. Align the culture to the strategy. Build the culture to create a thriving organization. But you take a good hard look and be open to understanding that there is a difference between a dependent, i.e., you know, a rules-based organization, and an integral culture, if you will, the impact of control structures versus flexibility. Expectations of organizational justice and fair treatment are really key. And if you see someone being told off by a leader for speaking up or challenging or, you know, questioning a view, that spreads. So understand how you can shift the behavior by the way that you respond. You made the point earlier about small actions make a huge difference, and that's absolutely true. And I guess finally, the thing that two characteristics that will help them and people around them to understand they really mean it are authenticity and connection, I think, are really critical because they will help an ethical culture to flourish.
Well, Jane, thank you for a fascinating conversation. I wish we had more time. I actually have a few follow-up questions. I look forward to discussing when we see each other in Berlin, and look forward to your session at the 2019 European Compliance and Ethics Institute. So thank you for talking with us today and for coming out to Berlin. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turtletaub from SCCE and HCCA saying, I hope we were able to expand your compliance perspective.